Joining me on the line is Allison Weir, founder of If Americans Knew, a nonprofit organization devoted to getting Americans the information they need to know about Israel, Palestine. Allison is also the president of the Council for the National Interest. Allison, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
Allison, if you could start by telling our listeners exactly what is If Americans Knew, and that's, of course, at ifamericansknew.org.
Sure, I'd love to. We sort of call it a think tank. The purpose is to get the facts about Israel-Palestine in particular and related types of information to the American public as widely as we possibly can. It's a nonpartisan organization, non-ideological. It's very journalistic in the approach. I am myself a former journalist, and I believe strongly that a democratic republic is only as strong as its media are. It's essential for Americans to get the full facts on all issues, without spin, without slant, without filtering them with some sort of ideological agenda, but instead just to get the full facts so that we will all then have the ability to form our own conclusions and decide on policies that we feel are the best policies for our nation, for our communities, and for our children. So our view is that it's important to get the facts out on Israel-Palestine to the American public because, sadly, the American media across the board, both liberal and conservative media, are giving Americans very Israeli-centric, filtered news reporting on this important topic.
And why do you think that is, primarily?
That's the difficult question. We've done a number of studies to prove that that's the case, and I can get into that later if you'd like me to.
Please.
But as far as why it's happening, the dynamics of that are far more complicated. It largely, I believe, has to do with the system that's in place and the sort of vulnerabilities of that system to people with an agenda who wish to manipulate that. So in this case, we're talking about, of course, largely a foreign issue. Most of the events are taking place on the other side of the world. So very few of us go there and see them in person. I've done that. I've had that opportunity. Most people don't. So most of us get our information from the media. Now, where does your local newspaper get this information? How many local newspapers and local television news programs have their own correspondents in Israel-Palestine? Almost none of them do. They all rely on these larger national entities to provide that news. Mostly, they rely on the Associated Press. That's the number one source of international news for Americans and really for many people around the world. Mm-hmm. It's very important. That's where our local newspapers get the news stories that they give us every day. So let's look at the Associated Press and see what's wrong there. It turns out that the Associated Press has one bureau through which all of the news about Israel-Palestine flow to the United States. That bureau is called the Control Bureau. This is a typical arrangement. Every region in the world has this type of thing. They have several bureaus, and then one bureau is the Control Bureau that everything is filtered through. So in the case of Israel-Palestine, to the best I've been able to determine this, AP will not answer my question. So if I have made any mistakes, it's because they won't give me their own information. But to the best of my ability to determine the facts, Israel has approximately four major bureaus in that region. Two of them are in Israel, and they are staffed by largely, sometimes exclusively, no doubt, Jewish and Israeli journalists. That's very good. They'll be plugged into the culture and the system. They'll get us the information. AP also has two bureaus in the Palestinian territories. Those are staffed largely, perhaps exclusively, by Palestinian journalists, Muslims and Christians. That's good. They will be plugged in. They will get us the information. Why, then, is not all the information coming to the American public? Why is it that AP reporting on Israeli children's deaths is reported at 7 times greater a rate than they report on Palestinian children's deaths? They're getting all of these news reports. Why aren't we getting all of them? Well, it turns out that the bureau through which all of this is funneled is, as perhaps your listeners have already guessed, one of those Israeli bureaus. So when something occurs in the West Bank or in Gaza, it may even have a dateline that looks like that's where the writer was filing the story from. It might say Nablus. It might say Gaza. In almost all of those cases, the story is actually written in Israel by a journalist who is quite likely Jewish and or an Israeli citizen. Therefore, they are giving it their own spin, either intentionally or unintentionally. We're all human beings, so it's either intentional or at times unintentional. Also, they are the ones choosing whether an incident is considered newsworthy. So when a little boy is shot in the throat and killed by Israeli forces, they don't consider that newsworthy. Now, if that were ever done by Palestinians, and it's never been done to my knowledge, it certainly would be headlined.
Sure.
So this is a big part of the problem. Also, what we find is that the Associated Press determines which of the stories that it even reports are considered big stories, which are the ones that are sent out on a separate feed to news editors around the country to decide which ones to put in their newspapers. Naturally, AP doesn't send out every news story from every region around the world. It chooses a few that it decides are the important ones. Well, the editors doing that seem to decide that these stories having to do with Israeli victimization are the important ones, and not the many, many, many more cases in which it is Palestinians who are the victims. As a result, Americans have no idea that in the current Palestinian uprising and the current conflict that began back in fall of 2000, over 90 Palestinian children were killed. Over 90 Palestinian children were killed by Israeli forces before any suicide bombings, before any Israeli children had been killed. The average American thinks it is the reverse of that. And the reason that the average American thinks that is not because he or she is stupid or prejudiced or bigoted. It's because that is the way the media is reporting it to us. They didn't report on those deaths. So how does anyone know that they're going on? This is just a sample of the problem that we're trying to overcome.
It's very important. What about what some critics would say is a Jewish-controlled media, not just here in the United States, but across the globe? Is there evidence of that?
You know, that's a very significant and troubling charge, and it needs thorough study to determine to what degree that's the factor and how significant that is. We have not done that. A number of people have looked into that. One of them is a journalist named Jeffrey Blankfurt. He is, by the way, himself Jewish, grew up in a Jewish family.
Mm-hmm.
His father had raised money for Israel back in the early days of Zionism. Jeff has looked into that, and he has published a list showing a very large degree of Jewish individuals, Jewish Americans, at very high levels in the media, throughout television media, print media, a very, very high, it appears disproportionately high representation in positions of influence, for example, either as owners or as the key editor that would determine the news coverage. So he certainly has looked into that and found a pattern that could be a significant factor in the extremely Israeli-centric coverage that we're getting. Also, of course, is the factor that these are businesses. A newspaper has to make money. Most of their money comes from advertising. So if a major advertiser or many small advertisers tell a newspaper, well, we don't like that you published something about Israeli forces killing small children. We don't like that. We consider that anti-Semitic. And we are going to drop our advertising from your newspaper if you continue such, quote, anti-Semitic reporting. Well, a newspaper publisher or editor is in great difficulties because if they go out of business, what good has it done anyone? They can no longer pay their bills or send their children to college, and they can't get the facts out anyway. So there are often advertising pressures on the media. There are organized boycotts against the media. These are against media that are already very Israeli-centric in their reporting. There's really no mainstream publication or television or radio program that I can think of that even comes close to objective, neutral reporting. All of them are Israeli-centric. But if they're not sufficiently Israeli-centric, then they get targeted with consumer boycotts, advertising boycotts, organized by such groups as the Anti-Defamation League. This is a mainstream Jewish organization. Organized by AIPAC, the American Israel Public Affairs Committee. Organized by the Zionist Organization of America. Such a thing does exist. I had never heard of it before, but it's significant. So we have this kind of pressure that's brought on the media, as well as the internal reality of who's actually in charge of our media, that are all major factors, I think, in the fact that we're just not getting the full facts on Israel-Palestine.
Yeah, I actually interviewed Mickey Huff, who you probably know, the director of Project Censored. And in the introduction of that book, they state that a well-oiled propaganda censorship and retaliation system promotes a perpetually lopsided view of Palestinians as attackers and Israelis as citizens acting in self-defense. I guess not too many Americans have seen those pictures of the settlers armed to the teeth with these modern American weapons, right?
That's right. And I don't think any television station, or at least any mainstream one, maybe some public access one, has done this. But no mainstream television station has probably ever shown what these settlers are like, has shown videos of them chanting, "We killed Jesus and we'll kill you too." That type of thing is just not reported to the American public. Most Americans don't know that it is Israel that consistently, many times a day, in Palestinian territory, kidnaps Palestinian citizens, sometimes kills them, sometimes injures them. That these invasions go on every single day. In fact, usually there are about 10 or 12 of them every day. It is not Palestinians who are invading Israel. That happens almost never. On the extremely rare occasions that that happens, for example, when there were these rare, very tragic and horrifying, but very rare suicide bombings, those were major headlines. But that happened very rarely, and only after enormous invasions and destruction and lethal attacks on Palestinian communities, killing children, disabling children, blinding them, horrific kind of invasions and attacks that eventually do cause some sort of response from any population.
You know, I interviewed Congressman Brian Baird, who actually was one of the few U.S. Congress people who went to Gaza and saw the destruction, and he's convinced that no one in Congress had read the Goldstone Report. Of course, it's a huge document, but no one had read it, and yet they still were able to vote almost unanimously to condemn any criticism of Israel through the Goldstone Report. Do you believe that? And if that's the case, is there any hope for at least Americans getting an accurate view of the situation via their representatives in Washington, D.C.?
Not via Washington, D.C. As you mentioned, I'm also the president of the Council for the National Interest. Now I try to spend about half my time in Washington, D.C. So you learn a lot when you're there and talking to people and hearing really a bit from the inside what's going on. And that Washington, D.C., sadly, is not going to take the lead on getting this information out to the American public. As you said, the Goldstone Report was very long. It was, I believe, about 600 pages. It was devastating in the information it provided, very factual. Mr. Goldstone himself was Jewish, very pro-Israel, so you couldn't ask for somebody who would do his best, as his daughter said, to not make Israel look any worse than the facts would make it look. If anything, believe it or not, he actually moderated things a bit. I think a more neutral person, the report would have been even stronger. But it was enormously strong as it was. And yet, here we have our Congress voting, as you say, with very few exceptions to condemn it, without having read it, without acknowledging the American role in what Israel did, which places Americans at great risk for having our tax dollars been used illegally by Israel to commit just this really horrific massacre of an imprisoned population. Their invasion of Gaza, they've invaded since. They're smaller invasions, so again, we never read about them. They do it all the time. They fly over all the time. They shell all the time. They've killed and injured a number of people since that occurred. This is like shooting goldfish in a bowl. The Palestinians in Gaza are largely imprisoned. Israel controls their borders. Egypt controlled the southern border, and the Mubarak regime did pretty much what Israel told it to do. How much that will change now that Mubarak is out, no one knows. Because the major players in the world are the United States. We're the most powerful nation on earth right now, to a degree. Except more powerful is Israel, because it tells us what to do in the Middle East. The major arm of its lobbying in the United States, AIPAC, the American-Israel Public Affairs Committee, often literally writes the legislation that our subservient Congress people then vote in favor of. And it is disappointing. This is across the board. We see people who normally in their personal lives, I think, live fairly moral personal lives, are, I think, patriotic Americans. And yet, in the case of Israel, they are so intimidated. And the system is so strong that they consistently do things that are unpatriotic and immoral. And I think they feel they have no choice. And until the American public learns the fact, they probably do have no choice. Because Israel has a record of targeting congressional representatives from both parties who have taken stands that were pro-American, pro-peace, rational, would have made the world better, would have made Americans safer. The Israel lobby has targeted those individuals and managed to get them thrown out of office because they funnel massive amounts of money to their opposition, which then has the best political propaganda money can buy, and it defeats what was a candidate of integrity, and nobody even knows what went on. because that has happened several times, most Congress people are afraid to oppose AIPAC because they feel, and they're probably right, that that will happen to them if they do it. Now, am I hopeful? I am, because fortunately today we have alternative means to get information out to Americans. It used to be that the mainstream media just had a complete lock on all of this. And they do still have much more power than the rest of us do. But now we have the internet. We have alternative media. We have the fact that many more of us have wakened up to what's going on and are sharing this with our communities. We're bringing speakers. We're putting on events. As you are hosting radio shows, I think more of us are stepping up to the plate, and that's necessary to do, and that's what will make the difference. That's my reason for optimism.
Some folks that I've spoken to over the years believe that, and of course, which is the relatively recent years, believe that the mainstream media is the internet or the alternative outlets, that what used to be considered the mainstream media should be called the corporate media, because most Americans, they feel, get their news from alternative sources. Do you think that's the case, or do you think most Americans depend almost exclusively on the corporate media?
I think most Americans depend on the corporate media. I think the younger generation increasingly goes to the internet. They're surfing a number of websites, and many of them are still reading the New York Times, the Washington Post, their local newspapers, Google News, Yahoo News. That's the mainstream media. I don't so much like the term corporate media, because it implies in this case that decisions on news coverage are being made by what will boost ratings or increase readership. Mm-hmm. And I don't feel that's going on, because some of the stories that these mainstream media have ignored would have boosted their viewership, would have sold newspapers, people would have been very interested to read them. So I don't think that's why they omitted them. For example, a few years ago, there was an event on Capitol Hill, a Capitol Hill briefing, in which very high-level U.S. military officers, a four-star admiral, a rear admiral, were announcing their findings into the Israeli attack on a U.S. Navy ship, the USS Liberty. On Capitol Hill, a former chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff announced that Israel had committed an act of war against the United States. Admiral Moorer also announced that facts about that very ruthless attack on American servicemen had been covered up by order of the White House and the Secretary of Defense. Admiral Moorer, a four-star admiral, also announced on Capitol Hill that President Johnson had recalled rescue flights that would have saved the lives of American servicemen. These are extremely grave, significant statements by an American of extremely high credentials. He was a World War II hero.
Mm-hmm.
He was the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. He was the highest-ranking admiral there can be. He made these statements on Capitol Hill in one of the briefing rooms, I believe in the Rayburn House office building. And yet, this was not reported on CNN, on Fox News, in USA Today, in the New York Times, in the Washington Post. Certainly, people would have been glued to their televisions to learn more about this. Normally, there would have been follow-up news reports. There would have been congressional inquiry. There would have been discussion and debate. That's what a healthy democracy would have seen happen. But the media completely buried it. Almost no one knows that it went on. To learn the facts, you can go to the congressional record, where the facts are there in detail.
Right.
This is an example. So this isn't the corporate media that would have sold newspapers, that would have boosted viewership of any channel that had reported it. Why didn't they do that?
That's right. I happen to agree with you that it's much more insidious than the strictly economic view. An American Free Press newspaper, they recently reported about how, and of course this was actually in the mainstream media, that newly elected Senator Rand Paul, of course Republican from Kentucky, wants to cut all foreign aid. And he was speaking to CNN host and, of course, former AIPAC staffer. And I think he was also the editor or one of the writers, correspondents of the Jerusalem Post, this fellow Wolf Blitzer, who, if most Americans do watch television, which I don't and I haven't watched TV for about 20 years, but if they do, they can see his mug on the boob tube. Wolf Blitzer asked if the cut in all foreign aid included Israel. And Paul said, when you send foreign aid, you actually send quite a bit to Israel's enemies. Islamic nations around Israel get quite a bit of foreign aid, too. I don't support funding both sides of the arms race, particularly when we have to borrow the money from China to send it to someone else. We just can't do it anymore. Is he a lone wolf on Capitol Hill, or do you think some more representatives and senators will come to this way of thinking, since basically the United States is, according to many estimates, just about bankrupt?
That's right. I think many senators and congressmen probably privately agree with him. That's what I've been told. But publicly, almost no one is likely to agree with him because of the power of the Israel lobby and because, as you note, people like Wolf Blitzer, who used to work for the Israel lobby, are the ones who will filter their words and decide the context with which they are given to the American public. So we would see Fox News, for example, trying to portray this as foolishness and making Americans unsafe, and they would try to portray it as an unintelligent kind of remark. The liberal media, CNN and the New York Times, would do the same thing with their type of spin. So I think right now Rand Paul is one of the very few who is willing to go out and publicly say that. His father also has spoken out, I believe. I don't recall seeing it on CNN, but I could as well have missed it. But I know that his father has also spoken out against stopping aid in general, and that would, of course, mean Israel, which is the number one recipient of U.S. expenditures abroad, even though it's one of the smallest and richest countries on the planet. It gets far more than anybody else. As a result, people like Rand Paul are being marginalized to the best of the media's ability and the best of the mainstream establishment's ability. Even though Ron Paul just won the CPAC Conservatives Conference vote to be the Republican nominee for president, This is unlikely to happen, even though it appears that he is very popular, and many of his fans are very popular. Not all of them, but certainly his anti-interventionism, I believe, is very popular, and I think his common sense about foreign aid is quite popular. Surveys have shown through the years most Americans believe in foreign aid when there's extreme need abroad, when there is a major famine and people are starving to death, or a major tsunami and people are facing a humanitarian catastrophe. Americans do want to help. But apart from that, most Americans feel we have enormous need here that we're not meeting. We have businesses going bankrupt. We have Americans losing their homes. We have old people that can't get their medications. So most people logically feel, well, shouldn't we address the need here? And only send it abroad when there's great need, we will do that too. Israel doesn't have great need. It's very wealthy. And yet it gets more than all of the starving countries in Africa put together of our tax money. Israel has a very strange and unique arrangement with the American taxpayer, because it gets it all in a lump sum at the beginning of the fiscal year. Nobody else gets that. That's not how I pay my electric bill. But Israel gets all of, quote, their money, and that's how it is seen by them and by their lobby. They get all of that money right at the beginning of the year without any real oversight whatsoever. And as you noted, since we're operating at a deficit, that means that we then have given away money that we borrowed. So the rest of the year and longer, we will be paying interest on money that we gave to Israel immediately. Israel doesn't need to spend it all immediately, so they make interest on the money. So the disparity is even greater than people know. And most people don't know even the simple fact that it's $8 million per day that we give to Israel. That has a population of at most 7 million people. It's probably more like 6 million people. So they get this massive amount of money in a very special arrangement, without oversight, without debate, without the American public ever discussing it, without candidates from both parties debating it. Here we're talking about many cuts to many federal programs, and yet we're not even discussing, people don't even know about this massive amount of money going to a very small foreign country.
Will they know?
I think they'll only know if they research beyond the mainstream media. And what happens, as you've noted with the mainstream media, it's not that everybody watches the TV news or listens to the radio or reads newspapers, but a certain number of people do, and then they sort of talk to their friends, and it becomes sort of accepted knowledge. Now, the thing that's interesting, though, is that there's still a residue of common sense that people have written about in crowds or in large numbers of people, and I think in the American public. That's why I think we've survived this republic through several centuries. There's sort of this residue of common sense. And what surveys show is that even though we are getting very Israeli-centric reporting, that's the mildest way I would call it, and often I feel it's really almost propaganda that we're receiving. So even though we're getting this very Israeli-filtered reporting, the majority of Americans will still say in survey after survey that they don't want to take sides on Israel-Palestine. They still correctly perceive that there are two sides. They correctly perceive that they're not sure that the Israeli side is really the right one, and they feel that we should stay out of it. In other words, they feel that we should stop the massive amount of tax money to one side if we're not going to give it to both. I think, in a sense, the American people are very reachable once we get more of the facts on this issue. And it doesn't matter if we're speaking to somebody who's a conservative or somebody who's a liberal or a Republican or a Democrat. Most of us really want fairly similar things for our country. We want a country in which our children and our grandchildren will be safe. We want a country that we can be proud of. We want a country that honors our ancestors, our parents or grandparents that may have fought in World War II. And our policies in the Middle East are not doing any of that right now. And when people get the facts, they tend to see that and they call for a change.
Right. And I guess a great place to start to get the facts is if our listeners went to ifamericansknew.org, and all you have to do is go to the second button, which is history, and click on synopsis. And there is a, as it says here, the following is a very short synopsis of the Israel-Palestine conflict. And I know even a lot of writers don't like to refer to it as a conflict because it's much, much more than that. But you start in the late 1800s with Zionism's founding. And the way it's laid out here, it's very clear, to me at least, how it all happened. And that these Jewish people occupying Palestine right now are not even indigenous to that area. They come from parts of like Central and Eastern Europe. Isn't that right?
That's right, especially at the beginning when Zionism was starting. This political Zionism that was invented in the late 1800s was a very secular movement. Most observant Jews found it extremely heretical and disliked it intensely. But they invented this political Zionism with the idea that Jews from around the entire world would flow into Palestine and they would there create a Jewish state. Now, let's look at Palestine at that time. At that time, in the late 1800s, early 1900s, Palestine was fairly fully inhabited. It's an ancient crossroads of history. Of course, it would have many inhabitants. And 80% of them were Muslim. About 15% were Christian. And under 5%, because there are a few other groups, were Jewish. And here you have Zionists in Europe deciding that they are going to bring Jews from all over the world to flow into a land and basically kick out 95% of the inhabitants of that land.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think, you know, any population would want that to happen to them. And yet
no.
That's the basics of what happened to Palestine. It was basically people coming from elsewhere and stealing somebody else's land to create an ethnic state that would be based on Jewish ethnicity, not on religion. Israel doesn't ask when a Jewish American from Brooklyn goes to Israel and wants to become a citizen. They don't say, do you believe in God? Do you observe Jewish religious laws and practices and rituals? Do you attend a temple? Are you a person of faith? They don't ask that. I'm not saying that they should, but they don't. All they ask is, are you ethnically Jewish? Do you have a grandparent that is Jewish? So it's very much a tribe, and it means that the people that lived on that land for centuries who were Christians, some of their ancestry, no doubt going back to the very earliest days of Christianity, are being pushed off that land and not allowed to come back. Muslims who lived on that land for centuries are not allowed to live on that land. They're being pushed out and then not allowed to come back. So it's a major ethnic cleansing project. Most Americans don't like ethnic cleansing projects. It's a pretty cruel kind of thing to transfer populations because they're not of the ethnicity that somebody decides wants. And then just moves, usually, of course, violently. People don't just up and leave their homes. So they violently dispossess people. Americans, we don't really want our tax money to do that. Why would we? And yet that's the Israel lobby does feel that that's a good use for our tax money. And they have successfully managed to get great quantities of our tax money that are sent to Israel that are then used in that type of activity. But not all of it is used for that, as Senator Fulbright determined a number of years ago in hearings into lobbies held on Congress.
Mm-hmm.
He found that the Israel lobby would lobby for our tax money to be sent to Israel, and then that money would be secretly and illegally funneled back into lobbying organizations in the United States who would use our own money to then lobby for even more money to be sent to Israel. The Justice Department has repeatedly tried to investigate the Israel lobby for practices that are quite likely completely illegal. But those investigations continuously are quashed at high level by Israel partisans and by people who are bribed or threatened by Israel partisans. That's the very sad reality of what's been going on. And I don't say any of this joyfully. I didn't know any of this was going on 10 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
I don't happen to be Muslim or Arab or Jewish or Palestinian. Like most Americans, I really had never paid much attention to Israel-Palestine before. But I became curious in the fall of 2000 when the Palestinian uprising began, and I saw a little bit of children throwing stones against tanks, and I just grew curious about, well, what is this issue all about? I think I'll follow the news coverage. And as a journalist, when I began to follow the news coverage, I noticed how one-sided it was. I noticed that we heard from and about Israelis much of the time, which is good. We need to learn that information. But I noticed we almost never heard from or about Palestinians, that we weren't getting the full picture. So with the internet, out of curiosity, I started to go on and look into it and was astounded at what I found, because you can find international reports, you can find reports, almost real-time reports from within the region itself. So I started to learn this amazing, disturbing information. And after a few months, it seemed so significant to me on so many levels that I quit my job. I had been the editor of a small newspaper in Sausalito, California. I quit that job, and I traveled over there in February and March of 2001 as a freelance reporter to see for myself what was going on. I traveled around Gaza by myself. I traveled around the West Bank by myself, and I saw what was going on firsthand. And when I came back, I started the organization If Americans Knew, to tell people what was going on there, what I had seen in person on that trip and have now seen on many independent trips to see for myself the situation in the region.
A lot of folks who are interested in this topic kind of stumble onto it like you did. I know an author who I've interviewed a few times, James Petras, who's written extensively about this. He had no knowledge about this, and it wasn't until he studied the Iraq War, this latest one in 2003, until he studied that and he saw who was actually angling and fighting to get us involved in this horrible situation there. He found out that it was mostly Zionists and mostly neocons. It's something I think that a lot of folks have in common. They don't necessarily focus on this topic because, as you said, and there's ample evidence to this point, there really isn't the information out there that someone will go, oh, yeah, of course, it's such a lopsided matter here. He just stumbled on it. You just stumbled on it.
I think with that example of James Petras, how extraordinary that a man who has been very political, a professor who has been very political, written about many, many subjects, had never previously written about Israel-Palestine. Even though he has a history of writing about oppression against indigenous populations and others all over the world. And yet he so belatedly wrote about Israel-Palestine. It's just an extraordinary reality. The information was there. Other journalists had been writing about it. There's the Washington Report from Middle East Affairs that had wonderful articles year after year after year. There's the author Donald Neff, who's written five of the best books on this issue, and almost no one has ever heard of Donald Neff. He wrote about it year after year after year. Stephen Green wrote two of the best books having to do with U.S.-Israel relations. He's there to be interviewed in Vermont. Almost nobody even knows about Stephen Green. Almost the only one anybody learns about is Noam Chomsky, who did write about this, but has disguised the significant role the Israel lobby played in the formation of U.S. policy. Another person who very, in great detail, wrote about who it was that pushed the U.S. into invading Iraq, a disastrous invasion on every level for Iraqis and for Americans, a disastrous quagmire. Who pushed us into that were these neocons, as the Israeli media writes about them, largely Jewish neocons. The person who's written the best book on that is Stephen Snigowski. He has every detail that gives full information about the neocons pushing the U.S. into this horrible war in Iraq, and yet almost nobody has read his book, even knows that it exists. That shows the pervasive power to prevent people from learning important facts about one of the most significant issues of our day. I just continue to be amazed at the ability to infiltrate and suppress information at every level. So it's not just the mainstream media. You find that the left-wing media that used to often be the dissenters weren't talking about this either. You find now that the movement for Palestinian human rights often seems to have people that have joined it and at times seem to have an intentional or unintentional agenda, which is to hide the power of the Israel lobby in creating these really very misguided U.S. foreign policies. So you see this constant effort going on at so many different levels around the country. It's only because I got curious about this 10 years before 9/11. I had already been there. I had already started interviewing many people, reading masses of books on this, doing internet research. It took me a while to realize that this was really as big as I'm afraid it is. you know, nobody likes to be the purveyor of such bad, disturbing news.
Mm-hmm.
But that's a journalist's responsibility. When there are important facts, it's our responsibility to get them out to the public. And I think all of us have to join in that. I'm doing things now I had never done before. I had never given speeches before. Now I'm invited to give them all over the country, and I'm glad to do that. I had never certainly created a website before. I had no idea how one went about that, and now I've done that several times.
Mm-hmm.
So all of us need to step out, step up, and do the things that are necessary to be done. If someone says, oh, you should do that, or they should do that, that means that individual probably has to take that step, because more of us have to shoulder this burden. It's way too much for me to do alone, and fortunately I'm not alone, but we need many, many more people to join us in trying to get this information out.
Let's say folks listening to this broadcast want to get involved in this. How can they do it? What's the first step they should take? Go to the website?
That's right. Go to the website. On the website, ifamericansknew.org, you'll see in the right-hand corner, there's a menu item, materials. If you click on that, we have produced many, many different booklets, fact sheets, cards, some videos, posters, a great deal of information that people can then distribute in their communities. We sort of all have to become the media. So people can order these materials or print them out themselves. We don't make money on this. And distribute those in their own community. They can invite me to give a speech in their public library on their campus. I'm happy to do that. There are many other wonderful speakers that can be invited to give speeches. They can contact their local newspaper and write letters to the editor, op-eds. They can tell other people, just their families, their communities, their rotary clubs, their churches, their temples. They can just share this information as widely as possible. On our website is a section called Action at ifamericansknew.org that has a whole list of things that people can do and advice and information about how to do them. Most of us have never put on an event at our public library before. It's actually very easy to do it, but most of us have never done it before. We should. We need to start doing that, and lots of people are. And on our website, we'll walk you through. Here are the steps to do that type of thing.
Right. I interviewed a fellow, an author from Canada, Greg Felton. You might be familiar with him. He wrote the book, The Host and the Parasite. He attempted to do that in a library up in Canada. And the Israel lobby, at least a faction of it up there, really came after him, guns a-blazing. If folks did try to do something like this in the library, they would have to be prepared for that, right?
I don't want to scare people away. I've been doing this now for about 9 years, so it's very possible and required, I think, for us to do this. But certainly there will be people who will try to stop you. I had one event that was going to be in Greenwich, Connecticut, and there, too, the Israel lobby tried to prevent it from happening. But because a public library is supported by our tax money, they cannot prevent an event from being held there. So what happened in the case of the Greenwich Library is that their opposition created great controversy in the town because we went to the media. You have to be very proactive. You can't sit back and think this is going to be easy. So we went to the media, the newspapers, the television, the radio, sent out press releases, made phone calls, alerted people. It became so controversial that, of course, the library had to back down. We would have filed a lawsuit if we had needed to do that. We would have won it. So it became so public and so controversial that the library, of course, had to back down. The event was held, and instead of getting, we thought we'd maybe get 50 or 60 people attending it, we had close to 350 people attending it twice.
Wow.
So probably at least 600 people came to an event because the lobby had tried to shut it down. So, yes, if you try to hold it in your library, Zionists will try to block you. But don't let them succeed. You have the right to do that as a citizen of your town, and you need to stand up for your right. I think all of us need to do that.
We mentioned James Petras and some other folks. It seems like any time an individual or a group comes out to provide a balanced view of what's happening in the Middle East, the Anti-Defamation League, who you mentioned earlier, the ADL, jumps up and classifies them as anti-Semitic, this, that, whatever else it is that is the flavor of the day, a self-hating Jew, if they happen to be Jewish. I plugged your name in the ADL's website, and I got a bunch of hits.
I think I'm one of their favorite people to hate. The ADL supposedly is against hate groups, but it really is very vicious itself and does everything it can to create hatred of individuals it doesn't like, and I'm one of them. You may have noticed it lists the 5 top anti-Israel people, and I'm one of them, the only non-Arab, in fact, I think, to be listed there. The top 10, quote, anti-Israel organizations, and If Americans Knew is one of them. By the way, also, another group called Jewish Voice for Peace is one of them. I am against hatred. I wish they were. So they're not targeting people that are haters or that are bigots. They are targeting people that are giving the facts about what is happening to Palestinians, about brutalities committed against human beings. These are important facts that we are getting out to the public, and that's why the ADL is targeting us. I used to have a good view of groups like the ADL. I thought it was a good group. It's not. It's disguised that way. What it largely does is defame other people. But it has much more money, so it can get away with that. Another group that I used to think was a good group is the Southern Poverty Law Center. Morris Steeves has become a millionaire, supposedly finding hate groups all over the country. He right. targets people that are not hate groups. So all of us need to start looking into these things that we may have thought were benign groups. We may have even supported them. And look into the real facts of Israel-Palestine. And then determine for ourselves what we think of the SPLC, what we think of the ADL. We often discover that they're not what we thought they were at all, that they're very different.
Absolutely. I had the opportunity to interview Mark Potok from the Southern Poverty Law Center, and he openly admitted to me that the term hate, which they use quite often at the Southern Poverty Law Center, and of course the ADL, and they work hand in hand, he told me that the term hate is not really defined. It's a very subjective term, and it's a term that they come up with. And that is quite alarming because they train between, I believe it's something like 2,000 to 8,000 law enforcement officials annually in hate crime training and so on and so forth. So not just are they throwing out a very subjective definition of hate. One of my guests recently said, hey, if I hate the Federal Reserve, if I don't like the way that system works, I guess I'm a hater.
Yeah,
they're infecting the level of the United States population that has a lot of say into what we can do, what we can think, what we can say out there on the streets or even behind our keyboards, law enforcement. So it is something quite scary.
I agree. I find it very frightening, very, very disturbing and very destructive and dangerous. Also, what's going on is that the ADL is really starting to create this whole infrastructure. They are largely manipulating that may start to interfere with some of our most cherished principles of the United States, freedom of speech, freedom of assembly, independence, liberty. It's very worrisome. People that don't think the way they do or see what they want them to see may be increasingly determined to be, quote, criminal, saying what I'm saying what you're saying, raising questions they won't like. It may create an infrastructure and sufficient changes to our laws and practices that people will be put in prison for this type of thing. This type of thing has gone on already in some countries in Europe. It's very dangerous, and more of us do need to be alert to what's going on. Many of us want to just live our private lives and raise our children to be good people and enjoy life and treat people around us with respect and decency. And most of us feel that should be enough, and it should be enough. But it's not when other people have an agenda and are starting to manipulate your country into doing things that are destroying your country and endangering your future.
That's right. And I think what people need to know is that these individuals and groups like the ADL, like the SPLC, they do not rest.
No, absolutely. They are relentless. They are relentless. You're absolutely correct.
It's really incredible. Now, I want to ask you, because you are pretty much one of the main targets of the Anti-Defamation League, and I don't know if you're a target of the SPLC also. Are you?
I don't think so. Truthfully, the Southern Poverty Law Center has not written much that I'm aware of about Israel-Palestine. That's one of the problems, because normally they're very, very supposedly on top of injustice, etc., and yet we have a major thing going on that they've ignored. But no, I'm not a target of theirs that I'm aware of.
Are you anti-Semitic?
No, I'm not. I have a life history of showing that I oppose all kinds of bigotry. I believe we should treat each human being with respect and compassion. I've had many Jewish friends. My kids always have. My daughter in her wedding, one of her bridesmaids was a close Jewish friend. Anybody can look at the life history of myself and my family and see that that just doesn't fit. We're not bigots. It's an unsuccessful smear.
If folks want to get more deeply involved in this matter and they go to ifamericansknew.org and they review, there is quite a bit of stuff on there to take a look at. So you're not just going to go to the website and get through it in a few minutes. You could spend several hours on that website, and you should.
Many hours.
Yeah.
There's so much on there.
Absolutely. It's great. There is a tab on there, or a button actually, in the top right-hand corner, right above Contact Us, which says Donate. How important is it for If Americans Knew to get donations? Is it something that is vitally important? How is If Americans Knew funded?
It's critical that we get donations. This is just so essential. Anything people can send us is greatly appreciated. Every dollar. You know, if somebody can give us 50 cents, we appreciate it. We are funded by donations from people. People on our website can do it. People can mail us checks, however they wish to do it. It is a tax-deductible donation. We are a 501c3 organization. We are nonprofit. You can write it off your taxes if you want to. But it is so important for us. We don't have many resources. Every year, we use up all the donations we get, and by the end of the year, we're usually without money again.
Mm-hmm.
Periodically throughout the year, we run out of money. So if anybody thinks, wow, they're doing something that sounds good, please send us some money, and please send us as much as you can, and please keep sending it. We're in it for the long run. It's not going to be a quick fix. You know, I'm hoping in my lifetime we'll see enormous successes, but, you know, I'm not expecting it next week. So I just deeply hope people will donate to us, because many good people are doing wonderful things and are donating money for medical care for people in the West Bank or food for Gaza or something. These are wonderful band-aids. But as Americans, we can go to the cause of the illness. We can change it. American citizens have the power to change this. And I feel that the way we'll change it is by getting this information out to the public. That's the way I determined that I think we can bring change. So any donation is just critical for us to be able to continue doing what we're doing.
Alison Ware, founder of If Americans Knew, and also the president of the Council for the National Interest, I want to thank you so much for taking all this time out to explain to our listeners about the organization. Listeners, if this is something that catches your fancy, go to ifamericansknew.org and check it out. And if it is, like Alison said, then click on that donate button. And like she said, she'll take 2 bits, right? 50 cents. If you want to be, is there a place on the website where somebody could give regular donations? Like, let's say somebody wants to give $5 a month. Is there a place where they could do that?
Exactly. We have that right there. When you click the donate button, it takes you to another button. And we have people that give us $10 a month. We have people that give us $100 a month. That just automatically, we then, if you click that, I believe it works that we send you an email reminder every month, and we hope send us the money. So that's wonderful. Giving us a lump sum is fantastic, but also giving us monthly sums are wonderful. Then we just sort of have that cash flow to keep us going. If it's confusing, if it's difficult to give on the website, people can mail a check or a money order. They can call us. There's a phone number there where they can reach us and discuss how to get a donation to us and learn a little bit more about our work. Maybe some people have held fundraisers in their homes, invited their friends in, and worked to raise money for us that way. So anything people can do is just greatly appreciated.
What is your annual budget, Alison, approximately?
About $100,000 a year.
Jeez, compare that to the Southern Poverty Law Center, right?
Oh, that's right. You know, our opposition has millions of dollars a year. And the trouble is, as I'm sure your listeners realize, that to be an effective organization, most of us are not rich. We have to get salaries. So you can get $100,000, doesn't pay very many salaries. Most of us work part-time. We work many hours that we don't get paid for. We have these materials that we send to groups all over the country, student groups, for example, that can't afford them. We still send them. We send masses of booklets and fact sheets all over the country to be distributed. And we ask for donations for them, but in many, many, many cases, we don't get them. We just send them anyway. In my personal life and in general, I'm a frugal person. So when people send us money, I try to use it as effectively as I possibly can.
I might even call you cheap, because I'm the same way, too.
That's right. I know I was with some friends in Washington, D.C. and going to an appointment, and they were saying, you know, Alison, you are allowed to take a taxi now and then. That is permissible to occasionally do that. You know, usually I save every dollar I can. So
right.
That's how we run If Americans Knew, where we are cautious with every dollar we spend.
Alison, again, I want to thank you so much for the time you spent.
Thank you very much for what you're doing and for having us on your show.